Hello, lovers of horses and lovers of mysteries. Welcome to the show that combines both of your interests in one handy package, Horse Mysteries. My name is David Edrick.
My name's Lisa Williamson.
Are you sure?
Most days.
And welcome to episode 2 of season 4 of Horse Mysteries. This week, by the way, if you missed last episode, I chucked horse bits out the window. I chucked it out the window. I couldn't think of any more horse parts to talk about as part of the problem. So, dear, what is this episode called?
I think it was called Gray Area.
Gray Area. Okay. Gray Area. All right. Would you care to elucidate? Would you care to elaborate? Would you care to read on, McDuff?
I will read on. Okay. So the where this takes place is the New River, which is near McCoy, Virginia.
The New River in McCoy, Virginia. Okay.
And the when is 4th of July, 1991.
Okay.
And the what?
All right. You're answering all the questions before you even get going. Uh-huh. What is the why?
There's no why yet. Oh, okay. Okay. But the what? So the what? So members of the New York Upper Connecticut Pony Club regional vaulting team have been hard at work preparing all summer for the upcoming championships to be held at the U.S. Pony Club National Festival in New Mexico. The team had moved into Virginia Polytechnic Institute in Blacksburg, Virginia, for their training camp the day before. But since it was the 4th of July, the group decided to take a break and go tubing on the nearby popular New River prior to departing for the competition on July 5th. So on that day, 2,000 people were at the park, and over 1,000 people are on the river tubing. Although the team launched together, the group soon separated in the rapids at McCoy Falls. At 1:15 p.m., 19-year-old Jamie Cooper saw his teammate, 18-year-old Andrea, or Andy Walnes, signal that she was heading to the far shore. Jamie saw Andy climb out of the river with her inner tube on the opposite bank. A short time later, when Jamie and his other teammate went to Andy's exit spot to meet up, she was nowhere to be found. Her friends searched for over 3 hours until becoming worried enough to call the authorities, which they did at 5:51 p.m. So members from the local Montgomery County Sheriff's Office arrived and joined the search, along with various other rescue personnel. So it didn't take long before the assumption was made that Andy had drowned. The area was then swept for her body, but nothing turned up.
Oh, dear.
So, who is Andy Walnes?
Yes.
So, Andrea Lee Walnes was born in December 1971 in the USA to parents Kim and Jack Walnes. Through Jack's job, the family was relocated to the town of Ennis in County Clare, Ireland, when Andy was just 3 months old. Both of Andy's parents rode and
enjoyed... Could you spell that town for me, please?
P-E-N-I... No.
E-N-N-I-S. I think you mispronounced it. Sorry, what is it again?
E-N-N-I-S.
E-N-N-I-S. It's not Ennis?
I don't know. I haven't never been there.
Tennis?
Tennis.
Do you say tennis, anyone?
Why are you looking at me?
I don't know. It's a question I'm just asking you. I'm wondering.
Yeah, probably I pronounced it wrong.
I wondered if it was the biblical name, Enos, E-N-O-S, the way you pronounced it. And then I was like, I've heard of an Ennis, but never an Enos.
Hmm. Well, it's probably Ennis. Ennis? Enos? Ennis. Ennis. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Back to our story.
If this all goes well, we can take a trip to Venus.
Yeah.
Italy.
Oh, okay, good. So both of Andy's parents rode and enjoyed spending much time at a local stable in Ireland, where they participated in the local fox hunting scene. So Andy herself started riding at age 2. She was jumping cross poles by the end of that same year. The family returned to the USA when Andy was 4, bringing with them 2 horses they had acquired in Ireland. One, a big gray gelding her mother had started working with at the hunt stable. So Andy's mother, Kim, described herself as a timid rider who was afraid of jumping. She had ridden her whole life, but was a child of a highly mobile military family and had had very little in the way of formal riding education, and so was largely self-taught. Kim recalled later that prior to her own father retiring from the military, she had only ever had one riding lesson. Later, she stated that, this is a quote, since there wasn't an organized pony club nearby, she made do with 4-H, end quote. I love that. My bias is showing.
Yes, your bias is showing.
Okay. So, even though she had little competitive experience, Andy's mom, Kim, knew she had something special in the bold gray gelding she had acquired in Ireland, whom she had named the Gray Goose. In spite of her own fears, and despite the fact that the nearest three-day event was over a four-hour drive away from their home, Kim took up the sport of eventing upon her return to the U.S. She started in the novice division, which is approximately 3 feet, where the gray would regularly just bolt on course as he felt the jumps were too small for him. As Kim moved up the levels, son Brian was born to the family in the off-season between the move from training level to preliminary. This was planned strategically so that none of the pair's competitive season was lost. Kim had, by this time, set her sights on becoming a member of the U.S. equestrian team in the sport of three-day eventing.
Wow.
Very ambitious.
Yeah.
So in those first 3 years that Kim worked with the Gray in the U.S., she credits the financial and emotional support of her then-husband, Jack, which allowed her to train and campaign the Gray as she moved up the levels. Kim stated, this is a quote, if he hadn't supported me financially and emotionally, I wouldn't have made it. When I was competing at Blue Ridge in Virginia, his company paid for him to be on the Concord so that he could be there in time for my cross country. His company would plan their meetings around my competition schedule, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah. Kim appreciated the contributions of her husband's employer for their support and flexibility. The small Connecticut town the family lived in also got on board and would fundraise to make sure Kim and the Gray would have the money for entries, transportation, and the like, so they were able to make all of their qualifying competitions.
Wow.
With no instruction nearby, Kim would prop books up on her riding ring fence so she could read them as she rode and try and emulate what the author said. With two young children, Kim would also set up a playpen under a tree near the ring so her children were supervised while she schooled her horses. She would take the children in the pram on cross-country course walks and nurse Brian between the phases of her events.
Been there.
Yeah. In 1978, Kim and Jack traveled to see the inaugural Rolex Championship at the Kentucky Horse Park. Kim stated to Jack, I'll be back here next year. This is a quote. He just looked at me and I said, there isn't one jump out here that Gray can't jump. We don't have the conditioning and the experience right now to jump them all together this year, but next year we will. So the next year, Kim and the Gray tackled Rolex for the first time at the intermediate level on a course only slightly modified from the previous year's world championships. They were the only pair to make the time.
So how high would these jumps be for this course?
At intermediate, that would be 3'9".
Okay.
Yeah. So like 2 inches below Olympic level, basically.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So you moved up fast.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the only pair to make the time. This earned the previously unknown pair an invitation to the USET training camp at Gladstone in New Jersey. Kim packed up her horse and children and hit the road. Being the only person at training camp with children earned Kim the nickname of Mother Goose from esteemed U.S. equestrian team coach Jack LaGoff. Within 3 years, Kim and the Gray had gone from being unheard of in the world of U.S. three-day eventing to becoming the talk of the town when they finished second at the advanced level at Rolex, Kentucky, behind Torrance Watkins in 1980, and then repeated the feat in 1981, only 0.2 penalty points behind three-time Olympic medalist Jimmy Wofford. The pair then went on to win the 1982 Rolex at Kentucky Horse Park. Kim then competed for the U.S. team at the 1982 World Championships at Le Moulin, France, and brought home individual and team bronze. Midway through the cross-country phase, her previously broken spinal processes separated from the muscles, causing intense pain. But Kim hung on, and the Gray got her through the finish line. Kim again rode through the pain the next day in stadium to bring home those bronze medals.
Wow.
The pair were at one point ranked number 3 in the world, placed second in the Boccolo CCI 3-star, rode in the World Championships in Australia, were named as alternates for the U.S. team at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles, and finished third at Rolex in 1985 after their comeback from a fall and knee injury the previous year. So after following her mother all over the world for her competitions, daughter Andy had developed a keen interest in equestrian sports as well. She joined the local pony club on her Connemara gelding Ebony, participated in eventing up the training level, so that's 3'3".
Yeah.
Was part of the winning PPG team at Madison Square Gardens.
Wow.
By her mid-teens, she started teaching, riding alongside her mother. And
When about would this be taking place?
Around 1980.
1980, and they're doing Prince Philip Games at Madison Square Garden.
Still, yeah. Yeah, 80 to 84, 85 is when this story takes place.
Wow.
Or when her mom was at the peak of her competitive career. So
I wish you'd put in some time markers like, you know, flock of seagulls playing and everyone wearing like neon clothes because, you know, that's everyone in the 80s wore like everyone walked around with leg warmers on and headbands. And,
right. Thoughtless of me. Yeah. Should have done that. Sorry.
A little bit more, you know.
Cultural reference points.
Yeah. This is more skinny ties and.
Yeah. Okay. Noted. Okay. So anyways, by her mid-teens, she had started teaching riding alongside her mother and would hop on difficult horses in her mother's clinics to help the participants. So Andy was described as cheeky, vibrant, cheerful, optimistic, helpful, a great ambassador, and an old soul. She loved to travel, had made it her mission to stand up against injustice, and did not shy away from conflict. At the time of her disappearance, Andy Walnes, 18, was a Virginia Tech sophomore studying sports therapy. Her plans after graduation were to join her mother at their barn working in the lesson program. On the weekend of her disappearance, Andy, ever independent, had traveled all by herself from her home in Woodbury, Connecticut, to Virginia Tech to work with the regional vaulting team in preparation for the upcoming Pony Club National Festival in New Mexico. So, following the disappearance. On July 4th, Andy's mother,
It's funny, like, because of Pony Club's British roots, I never think of America as being, like, a strong Pony Club place, but obviously it is if they're having, like, giant...
Oh, yeah.
Get-togethers at Madison Square Gardens and, you know.
And more recently, it's been at Kentucky Horse Park. They're doing it again this year. I think they call it here. It's called Festival. I think maybe it's still called Festival.
Yeah.
Like Taryn Corman went down and did tetrathlon there. But, Pony Club in the U.S. didn't start till the 1950s. So it's a little younger than both Canadian and British Pony Club.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, like when I went to Hong Kong, there was a U.S. team there. They actually won.
Okay.
And when I was in Australia, there was a U.S. team there as well. So, and then, yeah, when we had the championships here, there was a U.S. team. Oh, yeah, we had the, was it the U.S.?
Coach was here, yeah.
Coach, yeah. Both the coach and the chaperone stayed at our house here. Yeah. So, they do all that stuff.
They do.
Mm-hmm. And one of the girls that was in Australia with me, she then... Almost as soon as she got back, she went off to, I think, South Africa and did a big Pony Club thing out there.
Wow.
Yeah, U.S. Pony Club actually gets invited to more stuff than Canadian Pony Club does internationally. And U.S. Pony Club, last I heard, their numbers were about 10,000, which is about five times as big as Canadian Pony Club.
Well, yeah, but the country's bigger than ours.
Population-wise, yeah.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, back to our story. So on July 4th, Kim's mother, or Andy's mother Kim, who is recently divorced, recalled waking up with a strange feeling of dread in her new home of Lewisburg, Virginia, where she had a job teaching riding lessons. The next day, Kim was tracked down by the local police while she was in the middle of teaching a lesson. They informed her that Andy was missing. Kim collapsed on the spot. She recalled later that upon hearing that news, she immediately knew that Andy was dead. On July 5th, 15 divers, a search dog, a police helicopter, and volunteers from five different rescue squads combed the river. Nothing was found. The search dog was also used to clear the boys Andy had been with of any involvement, and the dog indicated that Andy was not in the river, but instead had remained on land. Kim, Andy's mother, spent the week following Andy's disappearance at the search encampment. By July 7th, the search of the immediate area was called off. It was determined that the last sighting of Andy was 25 feet inside the Giles County line, which was across the state line from Virginia into West Virginia. The case was then changed to a missing persons case, and because it had crossed state lines, the FBI were called in.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah. Andy's father, Jack Walnes, put up a $2,500 reward for information on Andy. On July 12th, Kolmorgen, the parent company of Jack Walnes' former employer, put up an additional $5,000 reward for the safe return or recovery of Andy's body. On July 18th, Andy's parents, Jack and Kim, talked to a newspaper about her, and as a result, the reward rises to $10,000. By August, the reward sat at $25,000. On October 8th, the police released a composite sketch of a man who was believed to be last seen with Andy on July 4th after she was separated from her friends. The sketch was created as a result of a tip and showed a bearded man with red hair. The vehicle described was a black Jeep, and the tipster believed he saw Andy getting into the vehicle with this individual. Later, the police were able to track down the bearded man and clear him as a suspect.
Okay. Why was she getting into the... Or she didn't get into
it? Well, it said the man believed he saw Andy getting into a vehicle.
Yeah.
So, running separately, but concurrently with the Walnes investigation, on July 9th, John David LaFon of Pembroke, Virginia, was arrested in the ongoing case of missing Virginia Tech co-ed Meredith Mergler, who had disappeared in 1987. On October 6th of 1991, John David LaFon was found guilty in the disappearance and murder of Virginia Tech co-ed Meredith Mergler. In court that day, LaFon's lawyer, Max Jenkins, announced that LaFon was now the prime suspect in the disappearance of Andy Walnes. Who is John David LaFon?
Good question.
John David LaFon, 31 at the time, was a police informant and construction worker who lived in the town of Pembroke, Virginia.
Wow.
What?
I'm just thinking of Clifford Robert Olson, who was a police informant and construction worker.
Yes, yeah.
Here,
yeah.
Who is, if for people who don't live in the Lower Mainland, who was a serial killer who operated here in the 80s as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, he wore skinny ties and leg warmers.
No. 1980? Yeah, maybe he did.
No,
I don't
not.
Think he did. But and I thought you were wowing Pembroke, Virginia.
Why?
Because it's one of the filming sites of Dirty Dancing.
Okay.
Population 1,100.
Huh.
Yeah.
And everyone there is a dirty dancer.
Yep. Okay, so LaFon had recently remarried.
Shame on you, Pembroke.
Mm-hmm. And was described as a loud, boastful, heavyset man with a bushy mustache. So following a four-year investigation, on July 9th, 1991, LaFon had been arrested and indicted on 17 charges for the abduction and murder of Virginia Tech student Meredith Mergler, who had disappeared in 1987. Mergler's body was found 14 months after her disappearance in a cistern in Giles County, Virginia. She had been shot in the face and chest. The Mergler case went to trial on October 1991. On the concluding day of the trial, in court, LaFon's attorney waived the sketch of the red-headed man, who at that time was a person of interest in the Walnes case, and drew attention to the similarity in appearance between LaFon and the man in the sketch. He asked a police officer why the police were looking for someone who looked like LaFon, and after the trial, announced that LaFon was being investigated in the disappearance and murder of Andy Walnes.
This is a weird defense strategy, isn't it?
I know. I'd be firing that lawyer. Toot sweet. Yeah. So LaFon himself denied any involvement in the Walnes case.
Huh.
Yeah. So
you would think he would have been under police scrutiny. Would have been hard for him to.
Well, again, you've talked about it before, but we'll hear a little bit more about the fact that it's different states, and you have all these counties and different. Yeah. Yeah, so
and elected sheriffs who are too busy grandstanding to do their job.
Yeah, so I'll read
a
bit.
We know all about it.
Yeah, we've heard this story before.
We live in Canada, but we know America better than Americans do.
Okay, so I'll hear about the Mergler case. So on October 17th, 1988, Meredith Mergler was a 19-year-old student at Virginia Tech University. Virginia Tech is a large research university located in Blacksburg, Virginia, population 44,000. The school specializes in sports and science.
That's too many people to be dirty dancing.
Mm-hmm. So Meredith had made plans to return home to North Virginia with her friend Ann Ryan the next day and was adamant that they get an early start. That evening, she went out to the Marriott, a local night spot, with another friend. At the Marriott, which had a restaurant and a nightclub, Meredith's friend met someone, and when it was time to leave, because Meredith did not have a car, she had a 2-mile walk home by herself. Ugh. She was last seen leaving the restaurant just after 11 p.m. When Mergler did not meet Anne Ryan for their planned departure the next morning, Anne became worried. Numerous friends called around looking for her, but it was apparent Meredith had not returned home the previous night. Anne then called Meredith's parents, and following that, the police were called. For the next 14 months, there were no leads in the case. On October 17, 1988, in Giles County, Virginia, 20 miles from Virginia Tech, property owner David Canode went to check on an old abandoned farm he had acquired in the remote rural town of Eagleston, which is population 142. These towns are getting smaller.
Yeah, well, no, they're getting, they were small and they're big and then they're small again.
Yeah. Typically, the farm was overseen by a local woman,
this
Lucy
town
Seymour.
Has too small a population for any Dirty Dancing.
Yes.
Yeah. You have to have like the right ratio of people to Dirty Dancing.
That's true. Must be right. Okay. So Lucy Seymour, the last time it had been checked on was August of 1987.
The last time this farm had been checked on?
Yeah. So this Lucy Seymour wasn't doing a very good job. So on this day, Canode, his father and family friend, Roger Whitaker. I don't know if it's that Roger Whitaker.
Wait. Was he whistling at any point?
I don't know. They were checking the property when the Canodes asked Whitaker to check the well. So usually the well was covered by boards. Whitaker noted that a
Boards?
Boards, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my voice is not working. I told you that earlier.
No, it's working fine.
Okay.
I'm just trying to clarify.
Okay. Maybe I'll just read that part again.
Okay.
Usually the well was covered by boards. Whitaker noted that a concrete slab was now over the well, but did not completely cover it. And we looked in. When he looked in, he saw a badly decomposed body of what appeared to be a woman in the water. The group withdrew from the immediate area and phoned the police. What neither Canode family nor Seymour knew at the time was that David LaFon and a friend had been using the farm over the summer of 1988 to cultivate marijuana, and the pair had used the well for irrigation. It did not take long to determine that the body in the well was that of Meredith Mergler. Decomposition was extensive, although there was still enough soft tissue remaining for authorities to be able to determine that she had been shot twice, once in the face and once in the chest. Ultimately, it was dental records that proved conclusive identification. Some of Mergler's personal effects were also found in the well, along with shell casings. An autopsy showed that the body had been exposed to high concentrations of both lime and water. As well, the two shots were determined to have been from a Remington 12-gauge, and either could have been the fatal shot. Additionally, it was concluded that there were no signs of drowning, so it was clear that Mergler was dead when she was placed in the well.
Yeah.
So following the announcement of the discovery of Mergler's body, LaFon contacted his friends and attempted to establish an alibi, claiming they were at a party together, although his friend William Link reminded LaFon that LaFon had left the gathering they had all been at by 11:30 rather than the 2 a.m. departure LaFon was trying to claim. Due to the remoteness of the farm, the police figured a local who knew about both the farm and the well would be an obvious suspect. However, efforts by the Blacksburg police and a private detective firm hired by the family failed to turn up any immediate clues. In the early days of the missing persons hunt for Mergler, David LaFon, who was a police informant in Giles County, contacted the Giles County Police to make inquiries about the Mergler case. Giles County Police Officer Lieutenant Bill Stables informed LaFon that he knew of no connection between Giles County and the Mergler case that was being investigated across the line in Blacksburg. In March of 1990, Stables interviewed LaFon's good friend William Link's wife in an unrelated matter, and at that time she informed Stables that LaFon had killed Mergler. She told Stables to talk to LaFon's friend, Doug Jones. Jones initially refused to discuss the case with Stables, but a friend convinced Jones that Stables could be trusted. Jones soon decided to tape a conversation he had with LaFon, then transcribe the contents of that into a letter he gave to Stables. Following this, Jones proceeded to record many more conversations with LaFon of his own volition. Finally, on July 9th of 1991, the police had enough evidence to charge LaFon with first-degree murder, abduction with intent to defile, use of a firearm with the intent to abduct, and use of a firearm in the commission of a murder.
I'm just kind of curious. So now if the police tried to surreptitiously record LaFawn, they wouldn't be allowed to, right? Or they have to get a court order in order to
I don't know record. How it works.
Because it's interesting to me, like, that a private citizen could just record a conversation with someone and then just hand it over to the police. But the police have, I would think, have limits on what they can. Maybe it's different now with all the homeland.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, people go in, you know, with
like a wire.
Wire. So yeah. You're allowed to do that. Police are allowed to do that.
I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Carry on.
Okay. So LaFawn was also charged with 31 other unrelated counts, including arson, grand larceny, breaking and entering, and insurance fraud. Bail was set at $250,000. The Mergler case went to trial in October 1991. One witness in the trial, Jerry Martin, a friend of LaFawn's, testified that a year before the disappearance of Mergler, he, LaFawn, Link, and Jones all drove up to the campus of Virginia Tech. There, the men discussed abducting a woman, and LaFawn stated that, this is a quote, "If we got a girl, we'd have to kill her because she'd recognize us," end quote. LaFawn tried to urge his friend to grab a woman, and when they declined, he said he would do it. Fortunately, on that night, LaFawn only went as far as approaching a female jogger and asking her for directions. LaFawn's former best friend, Doug Jones, testified at the trial that he believed LaFawn was guilty of the murder of Mergler. He recalled a conversation he had with LaFawn in the spring of 1988 when LaFawn came to his work, confessed that he had kidnapped, raped, and murdered a girl from Blacksburg, and then asked advice of Jones on how to make a concrete lid for a well. When Jones asked LaFawn what would happen if the body was discovered, LaFawn stated that the body wouldn't be discovered, as he had put it down a well and covered it in lime in an attempt to dissolve the body and keep the smell down. At that time, LaFawn was working for the Virginia Lime Company, so he had ready access to lime. Giles County Circuit Judge Dow Owens also allowed the tapes Jones made to be played in court, overruling LaFawn's lawyer's attempt to have the tapes made inadmissible.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. Following 6 days of testimony, it only took the jury 2 hours to find LaFawn guilty of the murder of 19-year-old Meredith Mergler.
I'm just imagining the lawyer, LaFawn's lawyer, saying in court, "Your Honor, we can't have these tapes entered into record. They have him admitting that he killed this woman. He's telling everyone, I'm a murderer. We can't have people knowing he's a murderer here in court. Then the jury will know he's a murderer."
Yeah, his lawyer didn't sound great.
Yeah.
So LaFawn was sentenced to life plus 12 years. Okay, so.
That's an odd.
It is, yeah.
It is odd, yeah. Isn't it?
Back to Andy.
So I guess life is not truly life. It's like.
Life, but if you do well, then you can get out. So I think that's just to stop.
But then you have to wait 12 more years.
Yeah. I think that's to stop people from getting off on good behavior or whatever.
Okay.
Running concurrently to this court trial is they're still searching for her. So on October 19th, 1991, the nationally syndicated TV program Mystery Reward filmed a segment on Andy's...
Have you ever heard of that show?
No.
I don't believe it's national.
And it's called Mystery / Reward.
Oh, I thought you said Murder Reward.
Maybe I did.
But it's Mystery / Reward.
Mystery / Reward.
Mystery / Reward. Never heard of it.
No, me neither. Maybe it's a... nationally on the East Coast.
it's a national show that never left the state. Mm-hmm. That's why it was national.
Yeah.
It was only shown in the United States. It was never broadcast in Canada. Yeah.
Hit the border.
it is.
Okay. So anyways, that show aired on October 24th, 1991. On November 1st, 1991, 30 miles from New River, up in the mountainous territory near the George Washington and Jefferson National Forests, a bow hunter tripped over some bones and realized that they were what appeared to be human skeletal remains. Nearby, the police also found a black bikini. The bones, which had been scattered by animals, were recovered in a wooded area in the Stony Creek section of the mountains of Giles County, just 0.3 miles over on the West Virginia side of the state line. The remains...
Was the bow hunter Ted Nugent?
I don't think so. I'm sure we would have, his name would have been.
It's more 80s. Mm-hmm.
So the remains were soon proven through dental records to be those of Andy Walnes, and the remains also showed that she did not die of natural causes. Since the body had been taken...
I knew this was going to take a terrible turn.
Yeah, yeah. Since the body had been taken across state lines, this allowed the FBI to join the search for her killer. So on November 7th, 1991, a memorial service was held at Virginia Tech's War Memorial Chapel, and Andy's ashes were scattered on her godfather's farm in Newport. A year after Andy's disappearance, on the 4th of July, 1992, investigators returned to New River to interview people who said they were there the previous year for the 4th of July holiday. On July 27, 1992, the Roanoke Times and World News went to court in an attempt to have federal search warrants unsealed. They won, and the warrants showed that federal agents had previously made a search of suspect John David LaFon's van in an attempt to find hair and clothing fibers connected to Andy Walnes. Unfortunately, in spite of the efforts of investigators from the FBI, Virginia State Police, West Virginia State Police, Blacksburg's Police, and the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, who together collected 500 photographs, countless hours of videotape, many boxes of items, including the inner tube marked NRJ369 that Andy was using the day of her disappearance, and four thick notebooks, there was still insufficient evidence to win a prosecution.
So they had evidence against him, or?
Yeah, but.
But not enough.
Not enough.
Huh. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of wondering if he did it.
I think he did.
You think he did?
Yeah.
Like you say, the police would have been not quite so. Well, I mean, so he was out on bail.
No, he hadn't been picked up for the other one yet. Yeah. And it was the timing was just because he got picked up something like 12 or 14 days after he killed Andy.
Okay.
Then he got picked up and put in jail for the other girl.
Do we know how she died, Andy?
No.
There's no evidence of
no, but I would guess she was shot because he shot the other one.
Yeah.
And it said it was evident from her remains that, it was not natural causes.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, no charges in the abduction and murder of Andy Walnes have ever been filed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they just kind of have hung it on LaFon, and then that's the end of it.
Yeah. By 1996, Giles County Sheriff's public investigators publicly made the distinction that they considered the case of the disappearance and murder of Andy Walnes to be an unprosecuted case, not an unsolved one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they pretty much have... They feel like they have enough evidence to tie it to the farm. Oh.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lack of hard evidence has determined that the case cannot go to court. So 5 years after Andy's death, her school picture remained tacked up on the bulletin board at the Giles County Sheriff's Office. Giles County Sheriff's investigators, Willie Lucas and Lieutenant Gary Price, along with a newly elected Commonwealth attorney, Donald Caldwell, were all hoping for a new lead. But unfortunately, nothing of significance has arisen since that time. In reviewing the evidence on file in the Walnes case, Caldwell had to make the decision that the case would be too difficult for any lawyer to successfully prosecute. Caldwell was very familiar with the case, as he had acted as special prosecutor in the Mergler case, since there was a conflict of interest with the Giles County Commonwealth Attorney at the time, James Hartley, whose firm had previously represented LaFon in a divorce case. Of the Walnes case, Caldwell stated, and this is a quote, "We have informally reviewed the facts to render what assistance we could, and at this time, in my opinion, there is insufficient evidence to successfully prosecute any individual in the Walnes homicide," end quote. So, at the same time, when asked 5 years after her murder if LaFon was still a suspect in the case, there was no affirmation of this, although Giles Sheriff Investigator Lieutenant Gary Price also stated, quote, "At this time, there is nothing to eliminate him," end quote. At his trial for the murder of Meredith Mergler, LaFon's court-appointed lawyer, Doug Brinkman, stated to Giles County Circuit Court Dow Owens that testimony about LaFon's prior misconduct that took place more than a year prior to Mergler's disappearance should have been deemed inadmissible and did not have a bearing on the current case. Brinkman maintained that allegations of prior misconduct were extremely prejudicial, and that hearsay testimony given by prosecution witnesses deprived LaFon of a fair trial. They appealed the conviction in the Mergler case. November 30, 1993, the State Court of Appeals upheld LaFon's conviction in the Mergler case. Parole was denied to LaFon on June 22, 2017, and again on May 5, 2020. 5 years after Andy Wallen's murder, her father was still making regular monthly calls to the Giles County Sheriff's Department to discuss the status of her case. Eventually, Jack remarried. He and his new wife, Linda, live in Avon, New York, and are still involved with horses. Between 2004 and 2012, the pair were campaigning retired racehorses in local events at the novice and training level. At one point, both were topping the leaderboards of the Career 2 program at their respective levels. Today, the couple are listed as honorary members of the Genesee Valley Hunt, which hosts events and hunter trials. In 2022, Jack was still active as a jump judge in the cross-country phase of the event. So Kim Wallen's great horse, the Grey Goose, in addition to representing his country internationally in 3D eventing, was also the star of the 1985 film Sylvester, starring Melissa Gilbert, Michael Schofling, and Richard Farnsworth.
Oh yeah, we watched that just a little while ago.
I know, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the Grey starred as the event horse Sylvester Stallone in the movie, which was filmed in 1984, and footage of the Grey and Kim on the Rolex Cross Country course was used in the movie.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Between 1984 and 1985, the Grey had almost a year off due to Kim being injured in a car accident. Once she started riding again, it was determined that the Grey had developed spinal arthritis. His swan song was a 1985 Rolex event where he finished third. He was then retired and died in 2000 at the age of 30. The Grey's ashes were buried at Head of the Lake at the Kentucky Horse Park during a ceremony held at the 2001 Rolex event. Kim Waltz took a long time to recover from the series of tragedy in her life that included her career-ending car accident, the dissolution of her marriage, the devastating loss of her only daughter, Andy, and the early retirement of her great horse, the Grey. She sank into a depression that lasted for many years. In fact, she has stated that, quote, "It took three of those years to truly come back to a life with feeling. And it wasn't until 2005 that she realized she needed to make a conscious decision to fully live again," end quote. So eventually, Kim returned to the horse world and continues to teach and give clinics regularly. She rides, but no longer over fences. Her current ride is her stallion, Gideon Goodheart, a dressage horse who is related to the Grey Goose. She completed a 2-year spiritual life coaching course and travels the country doing clinics that focus on the communication between horse and rider. More information on Kim can be found on her website, thewayofthehorse.com. All one word. Following Andy's disappearance, her teammates carried on to the U.S. Pony Club Festival in New Mexico to compete. They won their division using the music that Andy had chosen for their routine. There's now a perpetual trophy for the Pony Club Championship bearing Andy's name.
That's nice.
The abduction and murder of Andrea Wallens remains an open case. Investigators are still hoping for a new lead. Anyone with information that can help lead to a conviction is asked to call the Giles County Sheriff's Office at 504-921-3842. The end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, sigh.
Yeah. Tragedy.
I suppose some listeners would be mad at me for making little jokes during the show, but it's the only thing to alleviate the horrible, creeping dread that I feel through these episodes.
You started going, ugh, ugh. Making all these noises.
Yes. I just can feel it coming. There's nothing makes me sadder than, well, I don't know Andy, but a person who's like a little ray of sunshine and then just taken away from the world. That just always makes me so sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I'm saying is, if you're a crabby person, I don't care what happens to you. But if you're a little ray of sunshine, you know, it's just sad that person who just brought so much happiness to people is taken away so early.
Mm-hmm.
So young. It doesn't seem fair, obviously. It's not fair.
No.
That doesn't just not seem fair. It isn't fair. Not that life is fair, but
mm-hmm.
it's...
Well, and the fact that the guy, like, publicly to his friends, you know, proposed this thing mm-hmm. years before and then followed through at least once and no one said anything.
Yeah.
You know, well, and everyone knew. Everyone's complicit in that.
Yeah.
Like, why when that guy's wife or girlfriend was talking to the police, you know, if anyone had said anything, like I said, 2 weeks earlier,
yeah,
it wouldn't have. But even that poor Meredith girl as well. Yeah, no one is deserving.
Had they found the body when that woman reported it, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes with the timeline, obviously I had some trouble with the timeline because mm-hmm. you didn't talk about the fact that they were wearing wraparound sunglasses
yeah,
and
sorry.
Had short hair. We're listening to the latest Culture Club album. Then I would have known what was happening. But it's just, yes, it's an example of a particular time period,
mm-hmm.
you know, where people did terrible things. And yet there was this weird culture of, you know, snitches get stitches and people wouldn't tell anyone, you know, like that it was dishonorable to report your friend who is a murderer or a rapist, mm-hmm. you know, oh, I don't want to, you know, hurt my friend's feelings by telling people that he's a murderer.
Yeah.
What will he think of me? What will other people think of me? They'll think I'm a snitch.
Mm-hmm.
It's
it's a strange culture for sure.
Well, it's not just there. It's everywhere. I mm-hmm. mean, you've told me a story of something really terrible that happened to a girl at your high school and the guys just walked around and nothing was ever done about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And everyone knew about it.
Yeah.
But no one said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's everyone's complicit.
Yeah.
In that story. You know, so, I mean, I think it's just of the time.
Yes, definitely.
Police were the bad guys, and you didn't talk to them. Parents weren't cool, so you don't talk to them. You know, any sort of justice had to be meted out by your peers. And most of that stuff, it just felt like those sort of terrible things, the person deserved it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's still like that. Like a girl walking home at 2 miles at night. People's reaction to that isn't, oh, this is terrible. Oh, she was asking for it. What was she thinking? You know, as if it's her fault
mm-hmm.
that she can't walk home safely.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's changing a bit now, but I think it's still,
mm-hmm.
it's still there. Like people still, you know, here's a young girl. She was tubing. She's walking around in her bikini, you know?
But as were 1,000 other people.
That's where 1,000 other people.
It's not like she's the only one doing that.
But obviously she was a friendly, open-hearted person who did not have was guileless, didn't, you know, wasn't suspicious of people and somehow was able to be tricked into putting herself in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so obviously someone saw him take her, but mistook who it was.
Yeah.
You know, so they went after a different person who is a burly bearded guy,
mm-hmm.
but not the burly bearded guy who did it.
Right.
That's too bad. Yes. I mean, I guess you could look back and I'm not, you know, when I make these comments, I'm not blaming the police for this because mm-hmm. I think that this is a culture that was long established and that, you know, and it would never have occurred to them to think outside of the paradigm that they were in,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was that, you know, we're county policemen. We don't want interference from state policemen.
Right, yeah.
And we really don't want interference from federal police.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're going to solve this ourselves and keep out these other people.
Yeah, and you see it on TV shows all the time, mm-hmm. right? So the resentment that would happen between jurisdictions or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, the feds are here. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's terrible. You mean these guys with the world or nationwide reach?
Mm-hmm.
And truly nationwide, not like mystery / reward. Mm-hmm. That should not have a nationwide reach. But yeah, it's so strange, isn't it? That this kind of, you know, territorial pissing contests. And I'm sure the FBI was part of it too. They would come in and act all high and mighty, I'm sure, in some cases. And, you know, kind of lord it over the fact that they had Quantico and all this.
Mm-hmm.
They had Quantico, right?
Yes.
Okay. I started thinking, what is that, the CIA has Quantico? What Robert Ludlum book did I read about? It's been a long time since I read a Robert Ludlum book. It's an interesting situation and it feels so of its time, you know, like we did mention, you know, there was a local serial killer here in the 80s and it was really downplayed. When you think about it, like in terms of like how it's how much what's the word I'm looking for? How much it's exploited now, how much it's blown up now, serial killers and all that kind of stuff. At a time when there was an active serial killer killing children, you know, I was taking the bus by myself to go to guitar lessons in a building that had a poster for one of the missing children who had been killed.
Well, that's on your parents.
That's on everyone. That was life at that time.
I don't know.
That was life at the time.
Where I lived, it was different.
Okay.
Yeah. That's on your parents.
Okay. Yeah. That feels like, yeah, just everyone just kind of lived their life and went to the mall and you know?
Yeah, no, I just remember a lot of fear. I remember seeing it in the paper all the time, front page of the paper all the time. And it was on everyone's mind and everyone was talking about it. So, yeah.
Well, you know, I was in the press in those days. So I delivered the paper. So I had a bit, you know, I had that kind of reporter's, you know, kind of stony, you know, sense of, I don't know if it's courage, you know, just that real truth seeker, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, I was a bit different than other people, obviously, because as a member of the press.
Yeah.
I don't actually remember being on the front of the paper, in the front page of the paper. I used to read the paper when I was delivering it. Mm-hmm. I'd look at the headlines in the front anyway. Those were different days, though, because the headlines in the front of the paper were usually international things.
Oh, okay.
Which is not really the case now. Newspapers have become like community papers. They're more like the tiny, you know, hometown paper you get in the full of flyers once a week. That's what your major city newspapers become.
You know? Yeah, it's an interesting shift.
It is. Yeah, when I was a kid, I would deliver. It'd be like all about, you know, the Iran crisis, all the hostages and stuff like that. It'd be all on the front page, you know. And then, yeah, there'd be like local news inside the paper, but you know. People were interested in what was going on in the world in those days, not the fact that someone's complaining because their landlord locked their door on them or something like that, you know. Front page news. Person mad at landlord. Yeah. Poor Andy.
Yes. Yeah. Poor Andy, poor Meredith.
Yeah. Poor Meredith too. Yeah. That's terrible.
And poor families.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yes. Oh, sorry. I'm shaking my head. That's bad podcasting, everyone. Hey, let's leave this. Go to letters.
Okay.
Because we had a little comment our friend Louise wrote. Louise wrote to say, welcome back, Horse Mysteries. That's us. Mm-hmm. More shenanigans in the world of horse sports? How shocking. But at least no electrocution was involved this time. It's probably not good karma to forge documents to fake an illness when trying to dodge fraud charges.
That is true. I think Eric found that out.
Yes, I think he is finding it out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Louise. All right, well, let's talk about next time.
Okay.
What's the next story, dear?
It's called Sabotage.
Sabotage.
And it's all about the Beastie Boys.
Oh, really?
No.
Darn. I was looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called Sabotage.
Sabotage. And you'll have to wait till next time.
To wait till next time. And so will you, dear listener. So if you'd like to contact us, like Louise did, you can go to our website, at sneakydragon.com. That is our home of Sneaky Dragon. It's on the Sneaky Dragon Network. That's what we're calling it now. What the heck? Why not? And there you'll find this show. And underneath the show is space for your thoughts, your feelings, and whatever else you'd like to tell us. Or, hey, don't want to write on a website? Prefer to email? Well, you can write sneakyd@sneakydragon.com. That will come right to us, and we'll be happy to read out your comments and your emails. And do you know we have a Facebook page, right, called Horse Mysteries? Lisa posts all the shows there, so you can go there and leave some comments, and we will eventually read them. We promise. So, everyone, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Take care, and let's not murder each other.
Good advice.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.